At the heart of Buddhism is, of course, the three jewels, the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha. So let's just take a look at the way Dr. Ambedkar viewed the three jewels. First of all, the Buddha. For Dr. Ambedkar, the Buddha stands apart from the founders of the world's other great religions. Krishna, who Dr. Ambedkar sees as the founder of Hinduism, described himself as the God of gods. Christ is the Son of God. Muhammad is God's last prophet. Liberation, salvation in those religions can only come about through unquestioning faith in their revelation, in the revelation of those figures and in their claims. The Buddha, Dr. Ambedkar said, was very different. He was a man. He was a human being. He was a human being who, through his own efforts, had attained liberation through the most profound examination of the causes of suffering. He didn't offer salvation. He showed the way to liberation. He was a giver of the way, and it was up to the individual to follow that way, to practice that way. In the way we talk about it in India, the Buddha was Margadatta, not Mokshadatta. This is the great sort of slogan. He was a giver of the path, not a granter of salvation. The Buddha also, according to Dr. Ambedkar, allowed his followers to change things. If circumstances changed, the way of practicing Buddhism could be changed. In other words, in Buddhism, religion could be modified according to the circumstances in which you were living. And Dr. Ambedkar believed that the Buddha allowed this freedom to his followers because he was so confident in the core of his religion. The Buddha's teachings gave principles, not rules. So Buddhism can be flexible. And so the Buddha didn't sort of arrogate to himself a position where whatever he said had to be slavishly followed. More generally, Dr. Ambedkar loved the Buddha's humanity. In his magnum opus, The Buddha and His Dhamma, he includes so many wonderful stories from Buddhist texts which show the Buddha's humanity. There are sections illustrated with beautiful stories on such subjects as the Buddha's capacity to lead, his compassion, the way he could heal sorrow and care for the sick, the Buddha's tolerance of the intolerant, his sense of equality and equal treatment, his dislike of poverty, his dislike of greed, his joy at the beautiful, and his love for the lovely. And it's clear that for Dr. Ambedkar, the Buddha was the ideal man, the supreme spiritual ideal, which everybody could emulate. Secondly, what about the Dhamma? Dr. Ambedkar, I'm deliberately using the Pali form, Dhamma, and Dr. Ambedkar insisted on the Pali form, Dhamma, because in the Sanskrit form, Dharma in Hinduism means one's caste duty. So he said Dhamma is, of course, very different from Dharma. Dhamma, he said, is very different from other religions because it is in accordance with reason, first of all. This is a very strong emphasis of the Buddha's. He said, on one occasion, the Buddha, let any reasonable man come to me and I will convince them. The Dhamma holds together reasonably and it points to actual experience. The Buddha is always bringing things back to our actual experience and reason in his discourse. In itself, the Buddha's emergence on the scene is a revolution in Indian religious teaching. So the Dhamma is in accordance with reason. But then Dr. Ambedkar went further. He said that the Dhamma has a powerful social message because it recognizes liberty, equality, and fraternity. This might come as a shock to hear the Dhamma described in terms of a slogan from the French Revolution. But Dr. Ambedkar believed that he learned liberty, equality, and fraternity from his master, the Buddha, and not from politics. Dr. Ambedkar, of course, had his own understanding of liberty, equality and fraternity. By liberty, he meant being free to make full use of one's powers and potentialities. You're free not just to live or to work, but free to express your highest potentiality. It's interesting to note, he doesn't talk about freedom from, but freedom to achieve. Reminded of that line from one of Milton's sonnets, which goes, "License they mean when liberty they cry." And I think a lot of the time when people talk about freedom, they're actually talking about license rather than genuine liberty. Dr. Ambedkar's vision of liberty was freedom to develop your powers to the highest level. And of course, Buddhism's whole raison d'etre is to give people the conditions for such freedom. Then there's equality. Dr. Ambedkar didn't actually believe that everybody was equal. He said, well, there are enormous differences between people. So, of course, there is inequality in that sense. But by equality, he meant equality of opportunity. The caste system gave no such equality. It was just inequality in that sense. But the Buddha's Dhamma is a vision of equality. The Dhamma was for everybody, regardless of their position in society. The Buddha taught anybody who came to him. He didn't recognize caste distinctions. The Dhamma doesn't recognize these positions. The Buddha on one occasion said, three things shine on all equally. The sun shines equally on all, the moon shines equally on all, and the Buddha's Dhamma shines equally on all. And what about fraternity? Dr. Ambedkar said a society characterized by fraternity means a society that has open channels of communication between all aspects of that society, with all elements, between all individuals and all communities within that society. Where a society that's characterized by fraternity is one in which there's a conscious sharing of interests between people. He says fraternity essentially is an attitude of respect and reverence towards one's fellow men and women. And here we come really to the heart of Dr. Ambedkar's vision of the Dhamma. In The Buddha and His Dhamma, his great work, there is a section entitled Dhamma and Religion. And in this section, there's a discussion on religion and morality. We've already seen how important Dr. Ambedkar regarded religion, because he saw it as providing the moral basis for society. But here he takes the discussion further. In most religions, he says, morality is like a wagon or a cart that can be detached when it suits the religion. A religion might tell us, for example, to love others. Love our neighbour as ourselves, for example. But supposing those others criticise our religion, or are followers of another religion, or whatever, well then, it can be that we should not then love them. That we should criticise them, attack them, or worse. The injunction to love morality can be unhitched, therefore, from religion. But with Buddhism, Dr. Ambedkar said, it's different. Dr. Ambedkar said, Dhamma is morality, morality is Dhamma. Dhamma is morality, morality is Dhamma. Morality is the essence of Dhamma. But what is morality? The essence of morality, Dr. Ambedkar said, is love. Metta. Loving kindness. Deeds of loving kindness. That's morality. All moral codes in Buddhism, all moral practices derive from the first precept. Undertaking to abstain from harming living beings and engaging with deeds of loving kindness. But Dr. Ambedkar went further. He said that Dhamma, morality, love, is sacred and universal. It's sacred, it's holy, it's the holy of holies. For this reason, he says, Dhamma replaces God in Buddhism. Love, treating others with respect and with kindness, is the holy of holies in Buddhism. It's more sacred than a shrine room. It's more sacred than a pilgrimage site. And to offend against this love, this Dhamma, is the most serious offence a Buddhist can commit, that actually any human being can commit. It's the greatest evil. And this Dhamma, this morality, this love, is universal. It is to be practiced everywhere and on all occasions, regardless even of what others do to you. The Buddha is uncompromising about this. There are no grounds ever for hatred, for ill will. Hatred never ceases through hatred. It only ceases through love. This is an eternal law. This is the eternal Dhamma. It's very interesting to notice how our own order members in India have practiced in this way. In India, our Buddhist brothers and sisters are in situations where there is violence. Violence erupts in India very easily. I've been in situations like that myself. And in recent terrible inter-religious violence between Hindus and Muslims, some Buddhists, unfortunately, not among our own order members and friends and mitras, joined in, or were going to join in with the local Hindus in attacking Muslim shops in a Buddhist area. And our order members and mitras just stood outside these shops and said, "You're not going to do this. This is not what Buddhists do." They faced down the violence. And when you've got that sectarian violence, people become like pack animals. You really have to be very strong and very firm and very confident and very strong in your metta to withstand it. But they talked these people down, said, we're not part of this. We don't do this. So it's very pleasing to see order members following this sacred and universal morality, which is the Dhamma. So you can see why Dr. Ambedkar regarded religion as the basis for an ideal society. By religion, he meant Dhamma. He meant morality. He meant the principle of love. A society based on the Dhamma could never allow injustice, inequality, discrimination, could never allow the caste system and untouchability. The key to the creation of such a society is, of course, the Sangha, the people who actually practice the Dhamma, the third of the three jewels. And Dr. Ambedkar's thoughts about the Sangha are very interesting. Much of his thought centred around the Bhikshu Sangha, the monastic order. And before he converted to Buddhism, and I think afterwards as well, he was deeply critical of the Bhikshus, the monks, that he'd come across. He went so far as to describe the monastic order in one famous article, written for the most prestigious Indian Buddhist magazine in India. He went so far as to describe the monastic order as a huge army of idlers. You can get a bit of an idea of how he used to speak, who seemed to spend most of their time sleeping. He'd seen this on his visit to Buddhist countries. He'd seen the inertia in Buddhist countries. He believed that the Buddha founded a Sangha so that there could be an example to the rest of society of what an ideal society should be. Embodying the ideals of liberty, equality and fraternity. Also, the Sangha, he felt, should be a living example of the Dhamma, of love. But Dr. Ambedkar also believed that the Sangha had a duty to serve the people, to teach the rest of society, not only the principles and practices of Buddhism, but culture generally. And he referred to the great monastic universities of ancient India, which were universities. They didn't just teach Buddhism, they taught the whole range of arts and sciences. Members of the Sangha, he felt, should be well-trained and highly motivated. In fact, he said in this famous article, the Bhikshu Sangha should learn from the Jesuit order. This might be a bit alarming to the ex-Catholics among you. But Dr. Ambedkar knew, he'd seen how effective the Jesuit missionaries had been in India. They were highly educated, well-trained, highly motivated men who also, interestingly enough, didn't wear a particular monastic habit. They would wear the local dress so that they could actually work with the people, work among the people. Dr. Ambedkar also felt that more attention needed to be given to the lay Buddhist. There should be a proper conversion ceremony for lay Buddhists, for people who didn't want to become monks, so that they, and there should be a proper training program for them. So there was more of a place for ordinary men and women. In fact, he wanted the whole Buddhist community to feel that it was part of a Buddhist mission, that it was part of a whole mission to spread the Dhamma throughout the world. And it's interesting that Dr. Ambedkar's thoughts about the Sangha converge with Sangharakshita's, with Bhante's thoughts about the Sangha. If you look at our own order, it's neither a monastic order, nor is it a lay order. In a way, it kind of brings together Dr. Ambedkar's thoughts. It takes a long time to get ordained. Some of you I know, know that only too well. There's quite a lot of, in a way, training involved. And yes, we're quite particular about who teaches the Dhamma at our centres. We want the Dhamma to be clear so that people can really take it up. We want people, yes, to definitely be an example of what practising the Dhamma means.